What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Beyond the Game. My name is Gregan, and today I'll be chatting with Dom Sacco. So you've been doing journalism for what, like 10, 15 years?
Yeah, it's been a while. My first full-time role was in 2007, but I've always tried to tell both sides of the story.
At what point did you start to put a price on your work?
I had to. And now when I have three young children and a mortgage, it's like I have to hit this certain amount.
What dictates whether a volunteer should be getting paid?
I think the length of time has a lot to is something to do with that. If you're volunteering, I mean...
And that's what you're saying here, is having her write about that, It gave an angle that you can't really write yourself necessarily.
Exactly. You need these different voices on a publication content team. I'll say something maybe some might find a little bit controversial with what you've mentioned. I'm really glad you attended that event.
What's having a family like in the esports and gaming space?
It's tough. It's really tough. I'm happy. I do talk about them publicly. I'm very conscious of, I know some people do it, but I don't like using my kids as impressions.
Make sure to follow for future episodes and let us know who you want to hear from next. I hope you enjoy this conversation as we get to know Dom beyond the game. Dom, welcome to Beyond the Game. It's good to have you here.
Hello, thanks very much for having me, inviting me on.
This is a unique one for you because normally you're the one doing the interviewing as a journalist. So finally you're now in the guest seat. So you've been doing journalism for what, like 10, 15 years?
Yeah, it's been a while. My first full-time role was in 2007.
2007?
So yeah, 16, coming up to 16 years. Like,
my goodness.
But esports specifically, about 7, 8.
Yeah, so you started out as a young kid wanting to be part of magazines. Was it the official Nintendo magazine was where you started?
You make me sound so old. I grew up reading games magazines, had hundreds of the things over the years. Nintendo Official Magazine, Games TM, CVG, I think it was, and a few others. And that's how we got our news back then, before Twitter, before Twitch, before YouTube and all of that. And I realised, at school I was good at English, I wasn't so good at science and maths, so I naturally sort of found myself leaning towards games journalism. Wasn't well paid, still not that well paid now. I mean, it has changed a little bit. We'll maybe come on to that. Some of the esports publications, I think one of the reasons some have scaled back or gone under is because they were paying too much for some of their talent. But yeah, that's when I started out. And but when I left uni in 2007... no games magazines were hiring. So I had to just, I wanted to get a job somewhere, cut my teeth in journalism, and I joined Auto Trader there for 2 years. I don't know how I got that job because I don't know anything about cars, but after 2 years, then I sort of transitioned into games journalism.
And you said you were at university. What did you study at university?
Multimedia journalism.
So this has been your commitment for a long time, and it does show in the articles you write now. One of my favorite writers. One of the things I really enjoy about your writing is that you're articulate and balanced in your opinions. You give them across, but you try not to create enemies, which is the typical journalist opinion, right? People think of journalists as the evil person who's going to try and catch you out. But I feel like of the journalists that I know, you're the one who I think I trust the most to talk to, because you wouldn't go out of your way to maliciously write about me. Is that something you've tried to do in your journalism journey?
That's a really good question. I think if I look back, my stance on how I approach journalism has probably changed over the years. Maybe in the early days when I joined Auto Trader, news was my weak point. I wanted to be a features writer and an interview writer and a game reviewer. And then after a couple of years on Auto Trader, I wrote a story that went national, and then something clicked in me and I just realized, well, news is just something that people look at and it makes them go, wow, or oh my God, that happened. And then I started to move over to news. When I was at MCV, the Market for Computer and Video Games at Trade Weekly, I did write a few stories that were a bit, you know, sensational. And I learned that, you know, you get praise for them, but then you can also make some enemies as well. And for better or worse, I've sort of found myself as a journalist that is a bit of a fence sitter. Some people watching this might think, ah, Dom, choose a side, come on. But I like to be balanced. You know, I know for all their negative points, I've sort of respected the BBC a lot growing up and thought, oh, maybe I could work for the BBC. You know, now I'd have a different opinion on that, I think, with how things have gone. But I've always tried to tell both sides of the story. That was sort of drilled into me at university. I never really wanted to be a super controversial person or figure. Sometimes it happens. You will make enemies. As a journalist, you will write something that people don't like. You could write a positive article and someone will say, you're too positive. This isn't real. So I just try and focus on the truth.
Sometimes the truth is what people find controversial, because you're highlighting something that they don't like the fact it's being highlighted.
The truth hurts to a lot of people. And I've had in recent years, since taking Esports News UK full time, because this has been a journey for me, I've been doing it full time for 2 and a bit years now, I've had a few legal threats. I'm not going to lie, they can be scary, but I've written an opinion piece on this. They won't deter me, you know. I think the truth will always stand up. So, yeah, it can be a challenge, but I kind of relish the challenge, to be honest. And, you know, I don't get a lot of time these days to do the articles I want to do. I want to do deep investigative reports. I did one on Staffordshire Uni a couple of years ago. I haven't really done a big, deep investigative report since, but when you're spending 3-4 months on one article,
that's a lot of time, especially as a father, especially as someone you've dedicated your life to UK esports in particular. Esports News UK is your baby, you know. The thing which a lot of people know you for, that's been going now over 7 years,
yeah, that's right.
And so even when you were working for the British Esports Association, you still had Esports News UK on the side as a separate entity. What made you begin Esports News UK?
Another good question. I've always liked competitive gaming. When I was growing up, again, showing my age, Super Nintendo, Street Fighter, Bomberman, competitive games like that back then. I mean, I'd love to see Bomberman played as an esport. My goodness.
It's a lot more complex than people think. You know, when you're playing it one-on-one and the strategy and like checkmating people, it's a great game. 100%. Underrated.
Yeah, I had a little game shop near me where I grew up in Billericay. Games World, and they used to do games nights, and they do tournaments like £1 to enter and the winner wins a game or whatever else. And I learned a lot. I think one of the reasons why, not so much now, but I was a good gamer in my teens and 20s, was playing older people. You know, I'd be in there at 7, 8, 9 years old playing adults at Bomberman, and I learned a lot in those tournaments. I think I won one once, which people couldn't believe, but you know, I was beaten by this kid. What was your question again? I've gone on.
Why did you start Esports News UK?
Yeah, that was it. So, I've always liked competitive games. I saw that I was a big fan of League of Legends when that came out. I got into League of Legends about 2011, 2012, so a couple of years after it came out, and I started following League of Legends esports. At the time, I'd just become editor of a magazine, PC Retail or PCR. Which is like a trade publication writing about, you know, Nvidia, HP, PC vendors, that kind of thing. And I saw that some of these vendors and brands were starting to take interest in esports. And I was taking interest in it as well through League of Legends. And I had a press release one day from ESL UK about this new League of Legends ESL UK Premiership. And I thought, well, that sounds really interesting. It sounds like the Premier League of League of Legends. Little did I know back then how small, you know, that league was compared to the Premier League. But I learned pretty fast. And I tuned in that weekend when I received the press release. I think that press release was probably sent from Kuroda PR. So James Dean was there, who went on to work for and head up ESL UK. I watched the matches that weekend. I wrote a little report because I had a little blog back then on the side. Wrote like a match report, a BBC style, again, match report. Shared it on Twitter. Went to bed. And when I turned my laptop on the next day and checked Twitter, there were a lot of messages on there, people saying, oh, look, someone's writing about us now. Oh, we've got to watch out. There's a journalist writing about us. So I was like, well, I found a bit of a gap in the market. And I was a bit disappointed as well at other journalists and other sites that weren't covering the ESL Premiership. I was like, this is a pretty cool idea. We've got a UK-centric League of Legends competition. Why is GameSpot and no one else covering this? And, you know, not even an attempt at an article, right? Maybe there was a very small handful, more mainstream publications. So I don't like to say I've become a prisoner, in my own prisoner in a way, but I felt I had a duty to the scene to carry on covering it and writing about it, because I had people, as I built my name up, people would DM me saying, oh, Dom, I've got a new organisation or I've got a new team roster, can you cover it? So I felt like I had a duty. Unfortunately, around that time, I was becoming a dad. So it was very difficult for me in my personal life to say, hey, I'm just going to go off, do my own thing, do my own business. I didn't really have business skills. I still don't have amazing business skills now. I'm more of a content creator first. But that's why I took the full-time role with British Esports, and I carried on doing my news site in the spare time. So yeah, long answer to your question.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me because it is such a... an icon of British esports, UK esports, and has always been a consistent name that comes up time and time again. Something big happens, you see the Esports News UK article. You know, I've always enjoyed it whenever Rocket League comes up in it. It's always, oh, Rocket League's been mentioned on Esports News UK. And I think in particular, your association with British Esports Association at that time, when I first met you, almost kind of made me fall in love with the idea of UK esports and the potential future of a nationalized esports structure and system and articles and everything like that. What do you think British Esports Federation now, as it's changed its name, has become more official, and the journalism in the UK and the esports scene in the UK needs to be at the same level of other regions in esports?
That's a tough one. When I look at other regions that are doing better than us, you know, my background, my specialism is League of Legends. When I look at the likes of Spain and France that are ahead of us, it's... Do you know what? Actually, saying it out loud now to you, I think we need the backing of content creators more. This has become a topic. Richard Lewis did a video the other week about looking at content creators coming as org owners. Look at Rocket League, the most critical. I quite like the idea of that, and... I think Disguised Toast and other people like that are getting into esports now. I'd like to see some big content creators in the UK start backing orgs. Because at the moment, if you look at the big orgs in the UK, based in the UK, Fnatic, Guild, things like that, Method. Method have content creators with them. But in general, you know, you don't really have content creators at an ownership level or a management level. And I'd like to see that, because...
There's been a few that have got involved. So Vic Star got involved in the Royal Ravens.
Yeah, but it's just how much influence does he have? You know?
Yeah, and it wasn't done in the same way the other ones with the watch party style, the, you know, heavily investing in the product and trying to really push that.
That's it. I'd love to see 100% ownership. Vic Star is good. I'm glad he's a shareholder of Royal Ravens, but from my understanding, there are quite a few shareholders of Royal Ravens and so on. I'd love to see a sole ownership. I would say KSI, but I think he's been cancelled recently.
Yeah, he's had a rough time recently. To be fair, I've spoken a bit with some of the Sidemen people, and I think the problem they see is esports is not a sustainable space right now. And yes, there is potential to grow a brand there, but let's be honest, all those content creator-led organisations, they're using it as a marketing tool for themselves. Yep. They're using it to sell merch and all that kind of stuff. The big UK content creators like Sidemen, they already sell enough merch. They don't need it to sell that. What sponsors would they get involved? Would they use their own brands to sponsor? Because they can't have any of their competitors. They got food, they got drinks, they got shoes in their friend. You know, like there's so many challenges associated with that. And I do agree with you on the UK side of things. We do need a big content creator. I wonder who it could be, because let's be honest, the UK content creator scene is not hitting the same numbers in the gaming space as the likes of America or the French or Spanish speaking communities.
Look at Ibai. I always pronounce his name wrong. I think it's Ibai in Spain. You know, he's friends with loads of Spanish footballers. He's doing streams with them. He's doing big show matches.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe Quadrant is that. Maybe that's what it's going to be with Lando Norris.
This is why I've wanted to do an article for a while. Rich Lewis kind of beat me to it, but I would like to do my opinion piece because I've looked at Lando Norris. He's one example, and okay, he's making money from his racing, right? So even if he makes a loss with Quadrant, if he's enjoying it, I still feel like he'll want to pursue that. And in 10 years, Quadrant could be absolutely incredible. I mean, he's got so many followers. He's invested in Halo, and I think they're doing Rocket League as well.
Yeah, well, Lando Norris came along to the full major. Unfortunately, his team was out by the time he arrived because I think there was weather problems for his private jet. You know, some of the problems these people have must be tough.
But you're right, though, Gregan. It is. I hate to say it, but esports is a marketing vehicle. I hate to describe it in that way because to me, esports is so much more. It's the human interest stories. It's the rivalries, the competitiveness. You know, it's the ups and downs, the underdog stories. It's about people and it's about, you know, trying to be the best and competing on that top stage or amateur stage as well. But it is a marketing vehicle and it isn't in a great financial state. We are going through, I think, a market correction at the moment in 2023. I still think we'll come out strong at the other side. But, you know, I like to think I'm an optimist around that. But it is tough. Yeah, how can you convince people to come in when, you know, you're not projected to make a ton of money and it's like a hobby? And that's why I think for content creators that are the big, big ones that are millionaires and they can afford to lose a bit of money but do something they enjoy and give back, you know, and there are investors out there that want to see people develop as well as make money. Some will want to see people develop more than make money. Okay, maybe there's not as many. But that's why I say that. And some people watching this might think, "Oh, Dom, don't you think we need like a governing body and structure and so on?" How are we going to have a governing body when you've got esports is so fragmented? You've got so many different games publishers.
Yeah, that's the real problem, isn't it? The game publishers at the bottom are the ones who choose what happens above in their games. You know, like Rocket League, for example, is an amazing game that people have so many great ideas about, but lots of them get stopped at some point or other because the developer doesn't want that to happen. And then the same thing is true of the bigger games like Riot Games. You know, they have such big ownership over their big leagues that then the lower leagues are so reliant on Riot's control and investment in it that if someone who really loves, say, UK League of Legends comes up with an idea, they're going to be stopped at some point. Because at the end of the day, we're playing someone else's product.
That's so, literally happened as well. Yeah. We had leagues, UK leagues, that were shut down by Riot and Freaks 4U, when the tournament operator for UK and Nordics, because they wanted to do it in-house. Like, I don't, you know, I can't have a go at Riot and Freaks 4U for doing that. Freaks 4U have taken a model that's worked for them in the Dutch region, the Germany and so on. But we did lose some nice UK leagues like the UKEL and so on. And it does show that, again, I do like a little bit of consultancy on the side. And a lot of people, some people come to me saying, "Oh, Dom, there's money in esports. I've seen all these big prize pools and things." And I have to stop them and say, "I have to stop you there. There is money in esports, but where is it?" For me, it's the publishers and the pro players, maybe the top content creators as well, and top talent. Everyone else. It's quite tough.
So this is something you mentioned in your recent article about volunteering, and I very much resonated with the last bit you said, and it's particular about the sort of self-righteousness of people within the esports and gaming space. They are owed money in some way. And I look at an event like Insomnia as a great example of this. They put on amazing tournaments for the bring your own computer area where people can enter and win, say in the Valorant, I think it's £10,000 at this next event for a team of five. If they win, it's a small prize pool in the grand scheme of Valorant, but it might pay for their ticket, might pay for their weekend, might pay for their accommodation, might give them the money to be able to go off and buy a new computer piece so they can get better at the game, whatever it is. And there's been a lot of pro players who've come out of that system. In Rocket League, I know a lot of them, like Joyo, who's one of the best in the world now. His first tournament was at an Insomnia Gaming Festival.
Scrub Killer, I think.
Scrub Killer can beat that, exactly. So there's so many examples of how it's been a great place to develop your skills in Go. But there are still many players this day who are asking orgs to pay for their travel, to pay them a salary to compete these events. Or players are saying, I don't want to go because the prize pool's not big enough. A lot of these players are people who, at that point, have not made any money. They are still amateur. In a lot of cases, they are so amateur that they're paying money to enjoy their hobby. What's your thoughts around players lowering their expectations around how much money they should be getting out of a game and potentially looking at it as more of like a similar structure to sport where people pay to play the thing that they get involved in?
I've just joined a veterans football team, again, showing my age, and it's paid per match, whatever it is, £5. Or if you want to join a regular team, my son's coming up to join in under seven soon. I'm sure he'll have an annual fee to play in the league, and you've got to pay for your boots and all of that stuff. I think there's a bit of a disconnect between the amateur level and the pro level of esports. And I think that may have something to do with the digital nature of esports, how open it is, Twitter and so on. You know, it's quite easy to figure out roughly players' wages. And for whatever reason, okay, amateur players aren't going to expect to earn what Faker's earning and so on. But I think they see the pro players doing well and earning well and expect a bit of that as well. What can we do to change that? I'm not so sure. I think it's something to do with this market correction we're going through, because some people in esports, experts and analysts and so on have said part of this correction needs to be a reduction of player wages, because some are extortionate and the orgs are hemorrhaging money and struggling to survive. So something has got to give somewhere. But then who will be first to move? Because the orgs with the most money will get the best players. But that doesn't always work out, right? Team Vitality, whenever it was a year or so ago in League of Legends, built a super team and weren't very good. They looked like a team of individuals.
Yeah, it is tough, because then that's where you start thinking, is the support more valuable than the actual money that you're getting? And at what point is an extra 1,000 on top of your salary worth it? And would it be more worthwhile investing in a coach and stuff like that? And I think what you mentioned there about the sports structure, you know, there is a level in sport where you pay to play. You pay for all your equipment. You pay for your jersey. You pay for the renting of the pitch. You pay for the officials who are there, and so on and so on. At what point in esports should that be happening, I think, is a big challenge. And one area I've been looking at recently is university sport versus esports. Now, American football in the collegiate system, it costs them tens of millions a year to run the collegiate system. You know, these players are some of the best players in the world, even, because the American football there is treated almost professionally. But the players are still considered amateur. They get perks through scholarships, extra support, and so on and so on. But what I'm trying to say is, in sport at university, it is majorly amateur across all the universities, especially in the UK, amateur across all the levels. But then you look at esports now, and for example, the Rocket League scene, the collegiate system has prize money involved. So there are players competing at university in university esports, and even there, they're expecting to make some kind of money out of it. Is this an example of the difference between esports expectations and sport expectations around the prize money system?
Yeah, it's a good point, because if you look at some of the publishers based out in the US, some of their collegiate esports programs mirror the sports programs a little bit. Whereas here in the UK, we don't really do that. We don't really have we do have the collegiate system. British Esports do stuff. Digital Schoolhouse does a bit. And then you have Norlin NSC at the university level. But Norlin NSC, when I look at that and how they're set up, I don't think collegiate basketball and some of the collegiate esports in the US is set up in a way that it looks similar to collegiate basketball and so on. And again, that isn't my my strong point of knowledge, like US collegiate esports. But I know, I think that the US were among the first to have esports scholarships.
Yeah.
And offering things like that. And
there's a few current pros in Rocket League who are getting paid a pro salary to compete in RLCS that are also at college competing in the collegiate system.
Wow.
And I think the interesting difference in sport and esports is you're at your peak when you're young, so around early college years, just before college. Obviously, some of the bigger esports like Valorant, CSGO, League of Legends, players are getting older and older because the long-term development's there. But even then, they're not going to be going to university as a gateway into professional, because if the moment you leave university, it's probably too late to go pro.
Yeah.
And so in sport, a lot of those people would develop their sporting prowess at university or college and then go on to compete in sport into their late 30s, maybe even 40s in some sports.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that disconnect in the time frame for a pro player. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the esports, it feels even more rushed of getting a quick buck, maybe even a year or two of trying to earn as much money as possible. So people feel like they're owed that money. And then what we're seeing now is the fallout of after that, or where the orgs are unable to sustain that, that's now happening. So I think the greed that's coming from esports players that you mentioned in that volunteering article was really the self-righteousness that you should be earning money even if you're not at the top level in esports, where it should be done through, this is a hobby that I do on the side alongside my education or a job that I have.
Yeah, it's a very good summation of it, to be honest. It's hard for me to add something beyond that. When you look at football, you are right, esports is rushed because in comparison to traditional sports, because in esports you have a lower sort of lifespan of a pro player's career. You know, in football, some footballers, okay, I know it's rare, you look at Ibrahimovic, Ronaldo, they're going into their late 30s. I think Ibrahimovic is 40-odd now. Whereas in esports, the only game I've seen that's slightly similar to that is Street Fighter, where you've had players like Ryan Hart and I think Diego Umehara, I think if I pronounce that right, going in like late 30s, early 40s. But most games, and especially the team-based games and the fast games, people are retiring, aren't they, in their 20s and so on. I'm a big Arsenal fan. Ian Wright, when he joined Arsenal, when he went into professional football, I think he was mid-20s, which you wouldn't be able to do that as an esports player.
And he'll have been playing football for 20 years, maybe before that. Where esports come around and people develop those skills in a few years and then start earning huge salaries around a game that's just come about. So yeah, there is something there, I think, that will come with time with esports as the scene becomes old enough that there are people who are born with esports being there the whole time. And, you know, the young generation now that are wanting to be pro players are developing those skills, are training to compete rather than playing games, enjoying it, and then sort of becoming pro players, earning money, not being ready to do it. It's an interesting topic, but we will move on from it.
Can I just say really quickly, not every player is greedy, right? No. And there are some very good role models in esports as well. But in general, then I think there needs to be a bit of a market correction at some point.
Yeah, just on the market correction thing, I was thinking a little bit about investment. And in particular around Guild, that when that came about, the whole idea was enough investment would lead it to rise to the top of the scene. And then ultimately, if you're at the top of a growing scene like esports, as it settles out a little bit, you'll sit at the top as a top brand. And if you look at something like football, that'll be your Arsenals, your Manchester Uniteds, etc., where you have an exponentially larger fan base. You have exponentially larger ability to profit off of your brand, off of your merchandise, off of everything associated with you. And we've gone through that phase, and we saw the likes of G2, Liquid, unfortunately TSM were one of those that have now struggled a bit, 100 Thieves, all these organizations that rose to the top, and other orgs were like, we need to get up there with them so that when esports settles, we're with them. And what we're now seeing is a lot of those failed attempts are now the ones that are going bust. You know, like CLG recently just announced they're struggling. You know, in the last year, you could name dozens of orgs that have all struggled, and all of them were aiming to get to that top of the relevance within esports.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to see that, okay, actually we need to settle to not be a tier one org and instead be a tier two or a tier three org. And that's where I look at the likes of Endpoint here in the UK, who have always accepted where they are within the market space and have managed to monetize themselves as a, let's say, like tier three org. I don't know how you could tier orgs in that sense, but they have recognized they're not trying to grow to be the top org in the game. And consequently, they now have an HQ and have been able to fund that realistically without burning money with no return of investment.
They're an exception, I think, Endpoint, in the UK sports scene in particular. Yeah, I've got a lot of time for those guys. They've really impressed me how they've scaled gradually, not tried to do everything overnight. And I feel like I have quite a good personal connection with them as well, because Adam at Endpoint was one of the first... it was the first video interview I did when I set up Esports News UK, just before I was a dad and I had more time to do video interviews like you're doing now. And it's been great to see their journey. And they've got CEX on board, obviously, and sponsors and so on. They've just announced hardware partners for their HQ that you mentioned, which will be opening at some point in Sheffield. And they are a good example. And they know where they are. And then they sometimes get those big wins. They beat, I think, Na'Vi. Okay, it was only one game in a group stage in CSGO, but they have those cool moments.
One of the best in Rocket League at one point through good scouting and signing, you know.
Yeah.
There is an element of luck, obviously, with all these things. But one thing's for sure, though, is you've had to work hard the whole journey as a journalist, because journalism is not the easiest thing to monetize, especially as you first start off, you're very much working for experience. And you went through that whole journey, as I mentioned before, Fish and Nintendo magazine is where you first went to do some work experience. At what point did you start to put a price on your work, and how was that for you at first?
That's a good question. Can I just, it's just on my mind before we go on to
Yeah, of course.
When you were talking about those big orgs, I would say Guild and some of the others are probably late to the party, because those initial ones that were there right at the beginning, like Fnatic and Dignitas, they're the ones that when esports have settled, they're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
As long as they've got, you know, investment money and so on. Guild and some of the others, bit late to the party, I'd say. And it's very hard to establish a new org now. But anyway.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, on the journalism stuff, when did I think, to be honest, when I had a bit more confidence in myself, when I got that full-time job at Auto Trader, and once you start earning a living and you're on a full-time wage, you can't really go back to being a student again and scraping by. So I had to, you know, and now when I have three young children and a mortgage, it's like I have to hit this certain amount. And so that acts as a motivation to me. And some of my freelance prices will be high. If someone wants to hire me as a freelance writer, it's compared to someone who's straight out of uni, because I've got that experience, you know. So if I look at freelance, when I started doing that more, it was probably I'd been a journalist full time for like 4 or 5 years or so, and then I started to do a little bit on the side. And then when I set up Esports News UK, I had a bunch of people come to me, Riot, Red Bull, a few others, Betway, who wanted me to do some articles for them. And I do freelance now and then, I just don't advertise it as much. On that note, this year has been a little bit of a slow start for me, so I'm pushing myself more as a freelancer just to pay the bills, you know, because it's, you know, I'm not a commercial person. I need a sales team, really, but I'm a bit of a one-man band. We were chatting beforehand, before we recorded. It's that balance of, do you want investment, you want to work with an investor and have a team, but then you might have to work with people you don't get along with, you might, you know, those investors are on your back, and it's something to think about. And I'm still not fully decided. In 10 years' time, will I look back and regret that I didn't accept investment? Maybe.
I guess it depends how much money you're earning at that time, isn't it? It's very easy to look at it when you're struggling financially, or maybe I could have done better with a bit more money to invest in some ideas.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I say I'm scraping by. I'm not, you know, doing too bad. I'll be okay. But it's that balance, isn't it? And I'm not someone who's motivated by money. So if an investor comes to me and says, Dom, I'll give you X, Y, and Z, if I don't get along with them and the vibes aren't right, I'm not going to say yes. People watching this might be thinking, oh, you liar, Dom. But no, people who do know me know I'm not really motivated by money. So it's a tough one. It is a tough one. But good talent, if you're good at what you do and you're doing work, you deserve to get paid. But again, looking at journalism, I've heard some stories of some publications who've since cut back paying talent too much, and that may have resulted in why they had to cut back and have job cuts and so on. So, you know, that's something the industry needs to learn from.
Yeah, it is tough, because how much should someone get paid for something? And I guess that sort of brings me on to a topic I did want to talk about, because you've written a very good article about it, about volunteering. And at what point should a volunteer get paid? And in particular, it was around Insomnia Gaming Festival advertising for new volunteer spots around social media teams.
That's it.
And you've been on both sides of it. You started off in your esports space as someone against volunteering, you know, very cut and dry of it should be paid. If you're working at an event, it should be paid. And now you've kind of come to a more balanced, sitting in the middle, Sit on the fence, Dom. But I think the challenge you've got with the topic is it isn't black and white. You can't pay everyone. You also cannot make volunteers illegal or stop them completely, you know? So there is no easy way to describe it. When it comes to volunteering, you discuss all the different points. I guess the first thing is to look at what dictates whether a volunteer should be getting paid. What, in your opinion, what do you think should choose whether a volunteer should get paid?
I think the length of time has a lot to is something to do with that. If you're volunteering, I mean, for me, the term work experience, I feel like that's died out a little bit now, and it's got blurred with volunteering. You know, a volunteer, my mum volunteered at a charity for years. She didn't get paid, and it was a small charity shop, and she loved doing that. Okay, she's retirement age, so that's slightly different to esports, because a lot of volunteers in esports are younger people looking to get in. I think if you're doing a week or 2 weeks unpaid, I don't personally see a problem in that, because I didn't have a problem with that when I was doing work experience in Nintendo Magazine. As long as you get something out of it, try not to get pushed by the side and go and make a cup of tea and other nonsense like that. You might need to do a bit of running around, but have a clear goal if you're a volunteer of what you want to get out of that work, and make sure you've got that at the end of it. For me, it was writing for magazines, getting pages published so I could put in my on my CV and put in my record of work. I think if you're going beyond 2 weeks, who am I to say the length of time?
Yeah, because someone else might say 1 week, someone else might say a day.
Exactly, a day. Yeah. If you're going in, I don't agree in unpaid internships of months and months and months. I don't really agree with that.
The promise of a job at the end, and it sometimes doesn't turn out.
But then I've known journalists who, there was someone who worked for the London paper back when that was a thing. He was on my course at Bournemouth Uni. He did he contacted them. I said, hey, I'm looking for work. They went, we're not hiring. He went, I don't care, I'll do it for free. He just turned up and he worked for them for free for about 4 or 5 months. Then he got a job there. I don't really recommend doing that, to be honest.
That's sort of the point that a lot of people bring up around volunteering is the place of privilege. People who have got parents' money, or if you're a student and you're dossing about in your first year, you can go do some voluntary work. So in that sense, that idea of I'll work for you for free for X amount of time comes to people who can afford to do that. And this is, especially right now, this is why volunteering is particularly topical now. It's because a lot of people are struggling financially, and the whole thing is volunteering doesn't put food on the table. And I think that's the biggest point in favor of paying volunteers. So that idea comes from a place of privilege. But in the 2 week idea you said, and in particular for Insomnia Game Festival, which is the main topic here of where volunteering is a problem, that's a weekend. The volunteers get perks through it, and they are essentially paying for their ticket through doing a bit of work. And I think Glastonbury even describes their volunteering approach as work for your ticket.
Yeah, like Reading Fest, they all do it, I think.
Yeah, and the whole idea there is that you turn up, and I think in those cases you actually pay for your ticket and then get paid back for your ticket by doing the volunteering.
Right.
And that's to stop people volunteering at the event, sneaking in and then not doing the work.
And that's why I always pay freelancers after the work is done now as well. Little lessons and things I've learned over the years can be too trusting, but yeah.
Yeah, so the idea there being that volunteering at a festival has been a huge part of big events across the world, and thousands of volunteers partake in the biggest festivals. As someone who's been on the other side, you've got volunteers to help you out. When you're at British Esports Association, you got people to come and volunteer for you, and you saw it as like the work experience that you had gained at the Nintendo magazine, and you sort of applied it to these people for you. What was that process like for you being on the other side as a paid person getting people to volunteer for you?
Yeah, it felt very organic. I did advertise at one point when I was starting out Esports News UK, because people said, oh, Dom, you need to grow. Why don't you get some people to help you? I'm sure there'd be volunteers that want to help you do it. So I was kind of buoyed by the community sort of urging me on a little bit. I have that character in me. I do need a pat on the back every now and then, and a bit of kick and a bit of a push to go for it. But now, where I don't advertise for volunteers, I still get people emailing and messaging, hey, Dom, I'm looking to do this and that. And I say no a lot more now, partly because I don't have the time. Because if you have a volunteer, I like to give them the time, help train them up, give them feedback, give them advice, guidance, you know, review their work. I don't have the time to do that so much anymore. It's quicker for me, I know it sounds horrible, to do the articles myself. But then where it does work, in that rare circumstance, and I mentioned Hannah before the call, I think, Hannah Marie, shout out to her. Like, she contacted me a while ago because ALGS was coming to London and said, Dom, I'm going to be there anyway. Happy to, you know, I don't have any publications paying me. Happy to do some stuff for you. I was like, oh, that would be amazing if you want to do that. And then you do that as a sort of trial. And now she's been doing other bits for me. And then I try my best where I can to just give them tips or something. If an article is absolutely exceptional, I can't publish it for free. You know, I'd feel too bad. But then I don't have a bottomless pit of money. So it's a real hard balance to strike. I've forgotten your question now. I've gone off on the tangent.
I was just asking what it's like to be on your side.
Oh, yeah, on the other side.
On the other side when you've got volunteers around you.
Yeah, I've kind of been used to it. Because I've been an editor of a magazine, I've had a team that I've managed. Okay, the magazines I've worked on have been small teams, you know, business publications. You might have four or five on the editorial team. And then with sales and so on and production, it goes up to about seven or eight. So it's not like editing a national newspaper by any means. So I'm kind of used to being able to delegate work and things like that. But you need to have a lot of trust in people. And with esports, it's so digital. It's hard to get to know someone on a Discord call. I've spoken to a few people, a handful of people on Discord calls who've wanted to do stuff with me, freelance or volunteering, or even just collaborating with me in some way. And they're amazing on the call. But then they don't do the work, or they're difficult to work with. And then, you know, that can get tricky. And I think, to be honest, I'm someone that avoids things that I don't like, you know. So I don't work with volunteers as much because I'm mitigating the difficulty of, you know, having to work with different people. But then sometimes I miss out on, you know, you need a variety of voices to make a publication good. You know, what she wrote for me the other day was about this Women in Gaming event held by Black Twitch UK.
Yeah, I was there. I was one of the few guys.
I saw
guys.
You in the picture, actually. Yeah, there was a picture she took, or someone had took, that she used for the piece. Women everywhere, and then I spotted a Wild Gregan in the middle. Yeah.
Well, so I went along because a friend of mine was a bit anxious about going along, and another friend of theirs didn't turn up to go with them. And I was like, I'm going to be the only guy there. But I went along with them. And I do work with Women in Gaming. I worked with the Esports England team to try and get them prepped for the Commonwealth. Commentate women's Rocket League. So I've worked with women a lot, and honestly, I prefer to hear those kind of things from the women in gaming to understand it better. So I was fine going along, but I was like, I know I'm going to be the only guy there. And I was just sat in there as the only guy, and I was just thinking that, my goodness, I must look so weird being here. But to be honest, it was amazing to go along because I did meet some amazing women in the industry and learn some things that's hard to learn from the point of view of social media or, you know, talking to the occasional person. It felt a very great community there talking about it. And that's what you're saying here, is having her write about that, it gave an angle that you can't really write yourself necessarily.
Exactly. You need these different voices on a publication content team. I'll say something maybe some might find a little bit controversial with what you've mentioned. I'm really glad you attended that event, because sometimes I do feel, and I'm not meaning to take this people to take this the wrong way, because I'm a big advocate of women in esports, women in gaming, diversity in gaming, but I partly feel like I shouldn't be there at that event. That's for women to be there. And I feel like if I'd go, am I treading on toes? I feel a bit unwelcome. It might be a bit controversial for me to say that, but I do feel like that. So I'd rather have Hannah, and she kindly offered to do something for me to go. Because, you know, if that event is held and 50 guys turn up, it might be a bit awkward.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad you went, because it's like allies, isn't it, as well? You know, you need that. And it's not a anti-men event.
No.
It's a empowering women
event. A lot of it was, I mean, and this is the same thing for all women's communities in esports and gaming, is it's to create a place where they can meet other people, other like-minded people, have a safe place. And I think that event was amazing for that. I know a few of the women at that event were inspired by it and gave them the energy they needed to go back and keep fighting, because for them, a lot of time it is a fight. And I'm sure she won't mind me mentioning her, Meg, because I think she actually brought it up on the stream, who's been on this podcast. She said that she had kind of given up a little bit on being a woman in gaming and felt like she'd just been pushed away and didn't deserve to be in the space. And turning up to events like that was key for her to sort of relight that flame. Mm. But yeah, these kinds of events are key across all of gaming. I think it's the case for any group that feels pushed away. And I think, I don't know where we got to hear from, but I think events like Women's in Gaming, and there's going to be at Insomnia, I think there's going to be a panel by some of the women who are at that event.
That's it.
So I'll go along to that to hear what they have to say there. But yeah, I think it's amazing to hear you got Hannah on board for those articles and done it with the right intentions. I think that's key with the, to go back to the original point around volunteering, it's key that it's done with the right intentions and not done as free labor.
Exactly. And it's just what always happens, Gregan, is the best volunteers I have, they get snapped up pretty quickly by the Dixertos of the world or the Esports Insiders and the people that have money and investment. And I could go down the investment route and maybe I do need to ramp that up a little bit more. But the best ones get picked up quickly.
And that's what you're trying to do, though, isn't it? With your volunteering, you're trying to give them that.
I am, yeah. But it's only because they've come to me and they've said, Dom, can I help with this? Right? I can see that they want help. Mm. They want a platform. You know, and Hannah put a tweet out the other week saying, thanks, Dom, for letting me use your platform. And she complimented it, which is nice. So, yeah, I do want to do that. But, but it's still sad to see them go. You know, Jake Nordland at Esports Insider, Jacob Hale is at Dixerto, who's gone on to be a really good Call of Duty journalist. You know, he's doing a lot of UK COD stuff for me a few years ago. So, yeah, it's always tough to say goodbye as well. But you can't have both, can you?
I was speaking to Charlie, who was on the last podcast. He was mentioning how a few of his editors and stuff, because he's on a sort of smaller business scale of production and YouTube space. And he said all of his best editors get snapped up by the biggest YouTubers. And realistically, for that person, that's the ultimate goal, right? You're trying to give them that gateway. And volunteering, I guess, is the first gate for people to enter the space. And I think we'll move on from volunteering because I do hope to make a video about this when I'm at Insomnia. And
can I just tie in this to what you were saying earlier as well? Orgs, knowing their place. Are they a tier 3 org or they're a tier 1 org? I know I have a small corner of the internet. I know I'm not an IGN or a Daily Mail or whatever else. Mm. And I think it's about knowing that place. If I wanted to retain talent, then I have to do X, Y, and Z to get the investment. You know, Dixerto pulled in loads of investment over the years. I have to go down that road. Do I want to go down that road? So yes, I know I have a small corner of the internet and I'm kind of happy with it, to be honest.
I think that's the world we live in now, is everyone's striving to be number one because they can see it. You need to be content being...
And that might be, again, controversial, but people might be saying, oh, Dom, you're talking about esports, you don't want to be number one. Of course, it's different when you're a player. Of course, you want to strive to be the best. But if you're in an amateur league and you know that's your level, try and be the best at the amateur league, you know? Mm. Only one person could be number one.
Yeah,
people forget that in esports.
Yeah, and winning a league that's not the top league should feel good, but I think a lot of people are now feeling inadequate when they're winning lower levels because they know there's someone out there who's better anyway. Mm. But anyway, that's another deep topic. We've had a lot of discussions here. It's been probably the most discussy of the podcasts I've ever done.
Discussy. That's a new word, a pseudo word.
And I think it's been good because I know that's something that you spend a lot of time doing. You know, you've been in and around the space for a while. And it's always good chatting to you about your opinions and stuff. But I do have to ask you the same question I ask all of my guests, and it'll be interesting for you because you've been around gaming for a while.
Okay.
What are your top 5 games of all time?
That's a good question. Immediately, I don't know if... Does it have to be in order?
It doesn't have to be in order. You take it how you want to take it. It can be influential games on your career, on your life, or games that you just particularly enjoyed playing, nostalgia, however you feel you want to take it.
Immediately, I have to put Zelda Ocarina of Time in there because that's just... It was so magical when it came out. I read about it in games magazines for about 2 years or so before it came out.
Well, in games magazines. I remember, and this is a bit crude, but the official Nintendo magazine was a PG magazine, but it had a little bit of crude humor in it at times. And I remember my first ever... I don't know how to put this politely, but they made a joke about how it made them orgasm.
Really?
As a game, yeah.
I must have missed that one. I was too far too innocent for that.
I can't think it was official Nintendo magazine, but they kind of subtly put it in. I didn't realise what it meant until 5 years later or so.
Same, probably.
And didn't get it. Because they loved that game in the official Nintendo magazine, they always gave it like 98% out of 100 and no other game got close. So an absolute Nintendo classic.
And I love it as well because my son is 6 now. And, you know, he can't wait. We're going to watch the Mario movie soon or whenever this comes out. We'll probably have seen it. And he's getting into Zelda and he's frustrated because my wife, she's a real stickler for age ratings, right? I'm a little bit more lenient. And Zelda Ocarina of Time, I think, is billed more as a sort of 12-ish.
It's a hard game.
There's some bits later on that are a bit scary, bottom of the well and stuff like that. But Ocarina of Time, just for the memories... They re-released it a lot, and at one point, probably about 10 years ago, I was getting a bit like, I'm sick of Ocarina of Time now. I fell out of love with the game, but I've sort of gone back into it, and I think if they do a proper remaster on Switch or something, I'll be back in with it again. And, you know, Breath of the Wild sort of brought back my passion for Zelda games, so Ocarina of Time has to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
World of Warcraft has to go in there. I spent a lot of my time at uni playing World of Warcraft, and cool little story for you. Someone who I know in esports now, Raven, who's a Hearthstone caster, he was in my guild years ago.
Oh, really?
My old guild, Looty. We used to call it Looty Pold. Yeah, so,
I played Among Us with him, I think.
Yeah, so it's, you know, I got doors opened in the games industry weirdly for me through World of Warcraft, and it's a game I can go back to. I sort of describe it as comfort food of gaming, easy quests. Very relaxed, unless you're doing PvP and stuff. You know, I just do quests now. I don't have time for raids. So anyway, I'll try and speed this up a little bit more. League of Legends has to go in there because it has changed my life, better or worse. The UK League of Legends Premiership, it's just a very good game. Frustrating at times, but if you play it with a good group of friends, that brings out the best in League. You know, I like playing ARAMs with people and stuff like that. The other two, I would usually have... I would have them up there. I'd probably put Doom in there.
Okay.
Just, again, very influential, ahead of its time, very fun at the time. And despite it coming out when I was a young child, I was probably like 8 or 9, it wasn't scary. So it was family friendly. Okay, monsters, but it didn't scare me. Resident Evil scared me. I should not have played that game when I was 10.
Yeah, I think that's people... from older generations didn't really look at age rating as much. I think it does happen now, you know, people play games underage, but a lot of the stories of people who've been on this podcast is how I played Grand Theft Auto when I was far too young or played a shooter game far too young. But yeah, horror games as well. I forget that they can have quite high age ratings on them, 15s and 18s, aren't they?
Resident Evil has to be up there for me, but if I had to choose the fifth, I don't know, I'd probably go for something like... I'll tell you what I'll go for. I'll go for a bit of an... what's the word I'm thinking of here? One that someone wouldn't think of. Probably an old SNES game like Secret of Mana or something like that, or Chrono Trigger, because they're like an old classic RPG.
I've not heard of the other one.
Yeah, Secret of Mana, it's not aged very well. But again, when I played that at the time, it was very magical.
Yeah.
You know.
I think that's a lot of SNES games, though, isn't it? They were working with very few megabytes.
And
to try and make something magical.
But you can get them on the Switch now. I don't think you can get Chrono Trigger, but you can get the Secret of Mana, which is good. You know, if you'd have asked me as a boy, I would have just put Mario games in there. So Mario was a big influence as an extra.
Yeah. Well, I assume there'll be some Nintendo references with your love for Nintendo Magazine. I've got a little story about Nintendo Magazine before I ask you your greatest gaming achievement. So I had my best friend at school recognized my name when I got, you know, like when you get like listener or reader shout outs and like comments in there. I was heavily a part of the Facebook community and often got involved in a lot of stuff there. And they saw my name in the magazine next day, came up to me at school and was like, "You're in the official Nintendo magazine." Like, yeah, that was me and that page there. And that was how we connected over Nintendo games. We used to play Smash all the time together.
I love Smash.
And Pokemon and stuff like that. So yeah, official Nintendo magazine's a big part of my early hardcore gaming
life.
What
were you in for? I'm
it was just an opinion on a game.
Oh, right.
Like, okay. It was like, I'm well excited for this. So really, really boring like that. But then it would just have your name and then UK or something, I don't know.
I was in there for one thing where, because I did work experience, they called me up one day and said, Dom, we're doing this new feature we want to try out. Are you up for it? Is there a friend that always beats you at a game? And I had a friend who lived around the corner from me, Adam, who he always beat me at, before PES was PES.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
International Superstar Soccer, I think it was, on the Super Nintendo, N64, I think it was. And the idea was they come to your house, play your friend, and if your friend wins, he wins a bunch of goodies, and if they win, I win a bunch of goodies.
I
think he actually beat them. But that's they amazing. Said, because it's the first feature, we're just going to put in that we won.
Yeah.
So they gave us both some goodies. But Nintendo Magazine doesn't exist anymore, so I'm probably allowed to say that now.
Yeah.
But yeah, they said, oh, look, for the first one, we wanted us to win so we can show other readers that we can beat them. It was a close game, but my friend was very good, like, and still is very good at
games.
That's
all a lie. So. All these magazines are a lie.
Hey, yeah. But yeah, I don't condone that. But... Yeah, Nintendo Magazine as well. When you look back on it, it wasn't really journalism as such.
No.
It was entertainment.
Yeah.
Kind of like Nintendo Direct is now, I guess.
I mean, it taught me a lot about the games that were coming out. They do a lot of reviews on games.
Yeah.
But I would tend to flick through the reviews and look more at the fun bits.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, because I reviews for me are kind of separate to journalism. There is some crossover.
Mm.
If you look at... Linus Tech Tips and people like that review hardware, it's kind of journalism they're doing because they're telling you this graphics card is rubbish, go for this one. They're being truthful, but it's different to investigative news reporting, which is more what I associate with journalism. But you know, a lot of Esports News UK now is press releases because I just don't get the time, unfortunately. But you know, hey ho.
So another question I ask all my guests is, what is your greatest ever gaming achievement?
God, that is a tough... Oh, I know, actually. It's just popped into my head. So
that was nice and quick.
I was 26th in the world for Crazy Taxi, the highest score when that came out on Xbox. I know 26th doesn't sound very good, but I played that game religiously on the Dreamcast when it came out, in the arcades. I know the little tips and tricks, the little speed boosts. I know the map of the city inside out, so I know the shortcuts and things like that. And when it came out on Xbox Live, okay, the port wasn't very good. But after whenever it was, a month or so, I hit a good record. I think when I first did it, I was higher than that. I think I was like 11th or something. And then as the months went on, I got pushed down to 26th. So if you're saying top time ranking and that is Crazy Taxi, but then, you know, as a boy, it probably would have been winning that Bomberman competition at my local game shop. Because I remember one guy, you know, he was really tall guy. I was a little pipsqueak. I still am now, but I was like me at 8 years old. I was even shorter. And I don't know, I got put against him early on and he was like, who's my next challenger? He's all being all cocky and stuff. And he saw me and he sort of laughed like, ha, ha, like, and I beat him and that shut him up, you know. So winning that tournament and winning £50 or whatever, back then when I was 8 or 9, back in the 90s, £50 was quite a bit. You could have got whatever, 2 games for that.
Yeah, that's a lot of money for a young kid.
Yeah.
But no, I think the tournament was, I was wondering if that was going to come up because you sort of briefly mentioned it earlier on. I can see the way you're describing it, that sits with you as a great memory in gaming.
I will say actually as well, in League of Legends, a couple of matches in ARAMs, I've beaten a few casters who are like diamond level, which I'm quite proud of. Like 1v1, who did I beat? I did an ARAM, a Riot Christmas thing. I beat Munchables, I think was. And then before that, a few years ago, I beat Excoundrel.
Oh, yeah.
I successfully ganked him. So I'm quite proud of beating some of those diamondy whatever ranked players as well.
And they probably can't remember that at all.
It probably
if you
not.
Said that, they probably wouldn't remember that.
And I'm a low silver. Well, I peaked gold, now I'm bronze now. I've had it.
I mean, that's part of the challenge of being as old as you are in gaming. It's tough to compete at the top level. And also being a parent, you mentioned it a few times. I don't know how much you talk about your family publicly, but you said you got 3 kids.
Yeah.
What's having a family like in the esports and gaming space?
It's tough. It's really tough. I'm happy. I do talk about them publicly. I'm very conscious of, you know, I know some people do it, but I don't like using my kids as impressions on Twitter. So I don't mention them a lot. I don't mention their names or their pictures. I tend to just keep that to Facebook, close friends and family. But where I've shared some pictures, I'll put like an emoticon face above them just to protect them, their identity and everything. It is tough. Yeah, it is really tough. You don't get much time to follow the news and so. Well, that's what I do, right? It's part of my life. I'm watching podcasts. I'm keeping up to date on things when I'm putting them to sleep. I've got my earphones in while they're falling asleep and all that stuff, because I've got 2 3-year-old twins and then I've got a 6-year-old. So, yeah, it is tough. But I know other people have parents in esports, other content creators as mm-hmm. well. You know, Bizzleberry is a good League of Legends streamer in the UK. He's a dad. He seems to manage it pretty well. So if you know, it's like any other job, isn't it? I know esports can be more intense, and you know, I do sometimes think, again, some people might take this controversial, where I would have taken esports in the UK if I wasn't a dad. I think it'd be in a bigger place right now, but I obviously don't have any regrets and I'm happy with my life. But I do sometimes think about that, where I would have been.
Yeah, I think you look at someone like Frankie, who's got a pretty hectic lifestyle going along to events and having a kid at the same time, it does limit your potential to do a lot of stuff. And being able to work even harder than anyone else as a parent, that is a challenge.
I would say, I think it'd be harder if you hadn't made a name for yourself and you become a parent then. I think for Frankie, she was already a top host and then she became a parent. Same for me. Okay, I'm not at the level Frankie is at. But I carved a niche for myself and made a name for myself in that niche of UK esports before becoming a parent. Okay, it was only about a year before, but that helped a little bit, because then you've made a name for yourself. But then, you know, a lot of my readers, a lot of my friends in industry now have got to know me in recent years. So you have to stay on top of things. You have to, you know, if someone reaches out to you, I do like to take the time to talk to people where I can.
I guess the biggest challenge with being a parent in esports is the risk of that being your income, because it's not guaranteed. There is varying levels of income, especially within journalism, where, as you mentioned, sometimes you have to think about just paying the bills and focusing around that. Are you the only income in your family?
No, so I was. Well, it was difficult for a bit because my wife was on an extended maternity leave, because it's hard with twins. And you've got to weigh up. The government have just changed the rules around this, so we're a bit unlucky we missed out on it. But you've got to weigh up, is it worth putting your child in childcare and paying all of those fees, or not working and spending the time with them? And we chose the latter, you know, and built up the good bond between the parents and the children. My wife works part-time now. But okay, so that's helped us a bit financially. But for me, work-wise, it's made it harder, because it means I need to do the school run 2-3 days a week, do other bits and pieces. And I've given up. In the beginning when we did that, I would try and write an article in the afternoon when they'd come home with me, and maybe to stick the TV on or give them a snack or something, write an article. Kind of given up bothering to work when I'm in the same room as all three of them now, because it's pretty impossible.
Yeah, that's a lot to juggle. And it's not going to be your best work as well if you're focusing on as many different things as that. It's something, because, you know, I'm not thinking about family anytime soon. I mean, I first got to find a partner to do that. But the point I'm trying to say is that I've thought about, at what point do I feel comfortable with the income from esports to be able to sustain a family? Because ultimately that is a lot of young people's goals when they're starting to work, is they're trying to develop enough money, buy a house, family, pets as well, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I do often look at those who are in our industry, who are a bit older, who have got families, and admire the ability to balance it all up, because you are not only having to balance work with looking after the kids, but it's also the added cost of running
it's
a family.
And our weekly shopping bills. My eldest son, he's got dairy allergies and other allergies, so you have to buy the oat milk and other, it's all expensive. It is tough. I think if you do it gradually, you know, it was interesting for me, because I think my wife was ready for kids before me. Her younger sister had a child before her, and then that made her start thinking about it. I was more ready late 20s, but then by that point she'd gone into career mode and was doing well in her full-time career at the time, so she wasn't ready at that point. And then we waited another couple of years, around 30 was good for us. But if you're building things up over time, you know, like our furniture and all of that stuff and appliances, we had those before the kids came along. You know, I think if you do it gradually in your life, then it's less of an impact. But if you just jump into it, it's like anything. Yeah, it's a hard challenge to deal with. but I wouldn't change anything for the world. It's tough to balance, like, but like I say, they become your motivation as well. You look at life in a different way, you just naturally do. And they're my motivation now for doing well with Esports News UK. And I don't want to go back to doing Esports News UK part-time because I feel like I've let myself down, let the community down. But like I say, I don't think that will happen. And if anything, things should stabilise and improve in the future, fingers crossed, as I got better a little bit on the commercial side and so on.
Yeah, it's interesting you said about the motivating factor, because it's very easy when you are the only person who needs to survive off of the money, because you can be like, oh, you know, I'll take the hit today, yeah. I'll be a bit lazier, but then you're much more likely to be out of bed, springing into work mode, springing into family mode. And yeah, it's definitely the outlook thing has been the biggest comment I've heard from people with a family, is it changes your perception of why you're doing stuff. You're not just doing it for yourself anymore.
Yeah, exactly. You might have an idea like, you know, to get something for someone in your family as well. It might be a birthday coming up. You know, if you're by yourself, you don't have that as a motivation. It's like, well, if I do a bit of extra freelance the next couple of months, I'll be able to get that thing or do that thing. So yeah, you can, in a way, children do become a motivation. And, you know, my son, he's probably getting old enough now, I'll take him to an Insomnia and walk around the expo and stuff.
Wow.
I don't know how I'd be able to do work at the same, but do you know what he said to me the other day?
What did he say?
He said, when I'm older, can I write for Esports News UK? Can I do what you're doing? I was like, yeah, if you want to.
Oh, there
and
you go.
Maybe I've built a media empire and the Sackos will carry it on. I've got three of them, haven't I? So I've got a chance that one of them will want to do writing and like gaming in Esports. So we'll see.
Yeah, I think that's an exciting future, isn't it? As the next generation of kids come through and see Esports less as a, oh, you know, that game that I play a lot of, I can be a pro in it. And instead see that there's more layers to it, and especially being around you, they can see all the different layers that you've had an influence on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm aware of time because this evening you are running an event.
I almost forgot.
Yeah, that's why I'm lucky enough to have you here, Dom, is because you're in London on a one-off for an event, and I will be seeing you a bit later on. You do events with Esports News UK. You described it as a quarterly event. Is that an attempt to run an event every 3 months or so?
Yeah, I did it as an experiment. And I think this ties in with journalism. You can't just do news and expect people to pay for ads on your site, because, you know, you need a site that gets millions and millions of impressions. And even then, the Gen Z audience using ad blocker. So you need to do other things. You need to diversify, get other strings in your bow, or whatever the phrase is. And events is one of those. Is that it? Feathers in your bow?
Your bow, maybe? I don't know.
I can't remember what it is, but, you know, you need to be versatile is the point I'm making. So I've been doing events as a way, it's kind of a win-win-win, because it's a way for me to get like a headline partner. They get to reach the audience. I get to bring people together. It's fun, and it's a small revenue earner for me. And I could do bigger events and things in the future, but I just experimented at the end of last year with, it was a Christmas party I did with Nathan Edmonds of Sweet Cabin. There was a League of Legends Worlds viewing party I did, and there was a 7th birthday Esports News thing that I did, and they all sold out at the Shoreditch platform venue. This one's bigger, 250 capacity. I didn't quite hit 250, but I'm still happy with what I've done. And I looked at those events, I said, well, they've all done well. This one has got quite a few people come in, so I can do quarterly. But I've done it with Platform, the gaming bar in London. And every time I announce one, I get people saying, Dom, when are you going to do one up north? So I'd like to do one up north later in 2023. And hopefully they will be quarterly. If I can get a partner each time, I can do it. Or, you know, I have to put a higher ticket price in. But it's nice to have the support of the community and know that, you know, there is demand for these kind of things. And I think Esports News UK were quite an objective brand. You know, if you go to an XO Esports party, you know, and you're another org, you might feel a bit like,
yeah, you haven't got any conflict.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You're just there for everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I try and do anyway, unless you're a scammer or whatever in esports, then maybe not. But yeah.
I think we'll call it there, and you can head off and start getting that set up. But I do want to thank you again for coming on. A very different episode here, because it's more talking about your knowledge and the things you've been a part of and the experiences you've had. And I've always enjoyed chatting to you at events, and sort of learning Likewise. From you and vice versa, you know, discussing things. And I've always been a fan of Esports News UK because, as we mentioned before, it is not there to try and push an opinion, push an agenda. It's there to just show what amazing stuff's going on in the space and highlight anything that I think is important to talk about. And none more so than your recent article that was very well written and balanced around volunteering, which we did have a little discussion on today. So I do want to thank you again, and best of luck with the event tonight. I'll ask you the question I ask everyone to end the podcast, okay. And that is, what does gaming mean to you?
Escapism, but also community. So that's kind of juxtaposed. They're kind of at odds with each other. I started off gaming as escapism, as in an enjoyment, but going through esports, it is more about the community. And now for escapism, I have to do other things like read books and watch films or whatever.
Mm.
So yeah, I'll say escapism and community for me.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me on, and good luck with the podcast. I think it's great what you're doing, and you know, good luck in esports, as they say as well. I hope to see you on more desks and things in the future.
Thanks, Tom.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.